It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Tim Cook's going to give away his fortune. Ellen Powell loses in court. And the FTC should have investigated Google or not. We'll talk about it next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. It's time for Twit's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey. This is Twit This Week in Tech, episode 503, recorded Sunday, March 29th, 2015. Barbie Speaks. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com today. And by Little Bits, the easy way to build electronics with modular building blocks. Go to littlebits.com/twit and you'll receive $20 off your first kit, plus free shipping in the U.S. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twit and use the promo code TWIT. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And the luck of the draw has given us an all-female panel for this week's Twit. I'm thrilled to welcome back Jill Duffy from PC Magazine. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Leo.
Great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you, too.
You're in this New York City?
No, I just moved to Washington, D.C.
Oh!
Yeah. So
how nice.
I actually am looking at the Potomac out my window
right
now.
Oh, I'm so jealous. Don't swim in it. I don't think they've cleaned it up yet, but
no.
Good to look at it. Christina Warren was just in Washington, D.C. for a very important event. Christina Warren's here from Mashable, Senior Tech Analyst. Great to see you again, Christina.
Great to be here as always.
And Katie Benner's here. You've seen her on TNT. She's on, I think, with Mike Elgin when he filled in for me. She's a columnist at the Bloomberg View.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Nice to see you, Katie. I can't do what I do to Mark Milliam with Bloomberg Business Week. Bloomberg View doesn't lend itself to that, unfortunately.
No, you'll find a way to make fun of us.
I'll guarantee you that. So I think appropriate to begin with the Ellen Powell decision. Ellen Powell sued Kleiner Perkins, one of the big venture capitalists, probably one of the biggest, best-known venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, claiming discrimination, a jury trial, which she just lost. But I really thought that Farhad, we hadn't really covered it that much, frankly. I thought Farhad Manjoo in the New York Times kind of nailed it. He wrote, "Not only weeks of testimony revealed a collection of boorish, unsavory, and at times unwittingly misogynistic attitudes at one of the tech industry's most storied financial institutions, the case has also come to stand for something bigger than itself. It has blown open a conversation about the status of women in an industry that, for all its talk of transparency and progress, has always been buttoned up about its shortcomings." He says, thanks to Ms. Powell, notwithstanding the jury's verdict, the secrets are suddenly out in the open. So not a victory for Ellen Powell, who, by the way, is interim CEO of Reddit right now. But I think even she felt like there was somewhat of a moral victory. Do you agree, Katie?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's been interesting about this trial is that a lot of other incidents have happened in tech where women have felt like they've been harassed or they've been discriminated against, but most of them have settled, including a really sort of horrible harassment case against a different venture firm called CMEA that happened about a year and a half ago, and that was settled. So because she decided to take this to trial, it really, really forced people to look at something that they've been able to avoid for years and years. So I do think that there was a moral victory here, or at least a sort of awakening about how we should be treating one another in technology.
Frida Kapor-Klein, who is at the Kapor Center for Social Impact, said this trial would become a landmark case for women in the workplace, as important as Anita Hill's accusations, which also were fruitless against Clarence Thomas in his hearings to join the Supreme Court. I feel
like, you know, one of the things I think is funny about this is when you get into the specifics of what she was actually saying happened, it was stuff like they literally didn't let her sit at the table. I mean, that's just so ridiculous.
Right.
In my mind. Like, they made her sit in the back of the room instead of sitting at the board table with everybody. She was excluded from an event where everybody was going on a ski trip, and they just said, like, no, we can't have any women. I think their excuse was, like, some of the men are bunking together, so we wouldn't have a female roommate for you, and therefore you can't come. And then she had criticisms of her work and her performance that were really, really vague. So it's such baloney stuff that's so clear and so obvious. And I'm glad that it's getting some attention in the media. And we should be paying attention to this. I'm sad that, you know, nothing came out of it from the legal side, but it's just really ridiculous stuff.
I feel like she was very brave because these are hard cases to prove. I mean, one of the reasons there's such endemic discrimination in the workplace for women, when women don't make it the same amount as men and for the same job, is because it's so hard to prove.
Right. And I think that part of the reason it's hard to prove is because people don't speak up and they don't talk about things as they're happening. And if anything comes from this case, I think, you know, to Katie's point and to Jill's point, too, you know, the fact that we're actually having this conversation is a good thing, regardless of the outcome. And you know, if she'd had more proof or had gone maybe to people, you know, filed complaints earlier, I'm not saying that it would have made a difference, but I think that the more people speak up and the more people talk about things, whether it's through lawsuits like this or just actually getting HR practices to be on the ball, things like this can be better. I mean, one of the things this really case really highlighted was just how poor Kleiner Perkins' HR strategy around any of this stuff was. You know, they didn't have anything to really address sexual harassment or gender discrimination or anything. And for a firm of its size and you know, the amount of money people are making and the types of deals they're dealing with, that's shocking that they didn't even have anything like that in place. And so if anything comes from this, I hope that it's A, women feeling more comfortable speaking up, and B, feeling more comfortable in speaking up earlier so that there can be documentation for these sorts of things going forward, so that it doesn't have to become a he said, she said right. sort of scenario.
And actually, while the trial was going on, we saw a lawsuit filed against Facebook and then a lawsuit filed against Twitter, which has the potential to become a class action lawsuit if the plaintiff can find enough people. And I think that This speaks to your point that maybe people will be less afraid to come forward. I think that we've seen in other industries, whether it was media with Newsweek or Wall Street with Morgan Stanley, once you had these larger class action suits around racial discrimination and gender discrimination, it was much harder for tech companies to brush them aside or to say, well, this is just one woman and her story is problematic. And, you know, it's easier to pick apart one person's complaint than it is to pick apart the complaint of 40 people.
One of the things that's difficult in this is men, and I'll include myself here, tend to kind of be a little myopic. We don't even see it. And there's this kind of interesting disconnect between men and women when we talk about this kind of thing, where men go, what are you talking? I don't. And then women go, well, what, can't you? It's so. Have you all experienced these kinds of things? Were the things Ellen Pao talked about a surprise to you?
No.
I feel like I'd expect Kleiner Perkins to be a place where good old boys. It's a good old boy. It's the old boy network.
It sounds like politics in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and a little bit today. You know, like, you're literally not allowed in the room. There's no accommodations made for you. You don't have facilities and services for women available at all. You know, and we have to push for change in this, and it can't just be from women. You know, one of the things that I don't like about gender discrimination issues in the tech industry is we really focus on the women. What do the women need? Why aren't they getting it? Why aren't they more aggressive? Why aren't we promoting them?
Kind of blame the victim.
Well, it should be right. Exactly. It's victim blaming.
Right.
And it needs to be more focused on the men. What should men do? What should companies do? What policies need to be in place? I think it's in Sweden or Norway that they now have a law that says half of all boards of a certain size company need to be female by a certain date. So slowly and progressively, they're putting this law into play that is forcing companies to do business differently.
Wow.
And I think that if you want to, one thing you might want to read is go online and find a story, an essay that Sue Decker, the former CEO of Yahoo, wrote. It was posted on Recode. It's excellent. And she talks about the fact that she and pretty much every woman in the industry she's ever known has dealt with some sort of sexual harassment or discrimination. But sometimes when you're working really hard, you're willing to put those slights away and just set them aside.
Yes.
Because you don't really understand how grave they are until you look back and with, you know, the benefit of hindsight, understand that taken all together, that they were unfair. You know, and I think that the headline is something like, sometimes the fish are the last to notice water. You're just swimming in it and you're working all the time and you don't really put it all together until years have gone by. So it's a really interesting essay written by a woman who I think by all accounts has achieved so much. Nobody would ever say that she was not successful. And even she is willing to admit that she faced discrimination.
What I do hope is that Ellen Pound doesn't now face discrimination. I don't think she will. I feel like that even though she lost the case, people have a lot of respect for her courage in bringing it. And all you have to do is read into it to see that there was, certainly from her point of view, there was merit in the case.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, she's been in a good position at Reddit where, you know, she took over as interim CEO, and I think they've kind of been waiting for this to get resolved to make that permanent and whatnot. But by everyone that I've talked to who works at Reddit, who's involved there, you know, they went very quickly from kind of a toxic situation with their last CEO to a much better situation with her at the helm. So, I mean, I think that's good too. She's had the support of Reddit, which is good. But no, I mean, I hope to your point, she's not discriminated against. But at the same time, I think it would be hard for people to do that to her now because she has proven that she's willing to be so public about it.
Yes.
We know who she is, and there's something to be said about when you put yourself out there, you know, having a camera on things makes it uncomfortable, but it also means that people have to be accountable. So it's going to be much harder for people to treat her differently and to do this sort of systemic thing that maybe happened in the past. Merely by the virtue of the fact that a lot more people know who she is now.
I would be careful of the blowback issue, actually. I mean, I think one of the problems that happens, you bring up a case, you have the spotlight put on you, and then you're seen as a troublemaker.
Right.
Nobody wants to take you on. They won't explicitly say it's because you're a woman or it's because of past action, but they don't want to get involved with you anymore. And I think we have to admit that Ellen Pao she knew she would be taking this risk when she went to trial.
And she did.
And that's very brave. Yeah.
It is very brave. And I agree with you completely. I do think that it's important, at least in her situation, she already had a landing spot. You know, she was already on the board of Reddit. She already had this interim CEO stuff. She had, you know, her compensation package, even when she was let go, was considerably more than most of us. She's, without a doubt, I'm not trying to say that she wasn't extremely brave to bring this forward, but let's also acknowledge her great privilege in having the ability to even bring this case forward. And I think that actually says a lot right there, that it took someone with the means that she has and with the connections and with the stature it took someone of her stature to do this, because I don't know if this issue would have gotten as much attention if it was a lesser person, a lesser firm. I think that someone else would have just settled for that very reason that you point out, Jill. I think they would have been worried about the blowback. She's at least in a position where it's going to be much harder for her personally to face that blowback because of the other things that she has going for her and because of, you know, the things she's built up in the career that she's established for herself.
Well, there you go. She lost, but she won. And I think there are people comparing her to Rosa Parks, especially because she was forced to sit in the back of the airplane, that there's a certain similarity. I think a lot of kudos, a lot of praise to Ellen Pao for fighting that fight. And whether win or lose, I think it was very important. We're going to take a break. Come back when we talk about, I want to talk about the FTC report on Google. We had a great conversation on Wednesday on Twig. The Wall Street Journal, through a Freedom of Information Act, got a FTC report that was submitted, but kind of ignored by FTC commissioners. The commissioners 2 years ago decided not to go after Google. This report from the FTC attorneys said, you need to go after Google. They are really acting monopolistically. We'll talk about that and a lot more. And I guess we can also say, we'll throw in a little Apple Watch news, because why not? What else is there to Are you so sick to death of the Apple Watch, you just say, let's not talk about it until it comes out? I think that's probably the sensible thing to do at this point. Who's going to buy one?
Oh, I am.
Anybody with $10,000 to blow.
No. $350. This is the great part.
It is.
I suddenly realized the whole strategy. Who was it that said the great thing about drinking a can of Coke is you're drinking the same exact can of Coke as a billionaire drinks?
Yeah, that was Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol.
Right. Yes.
So if you buy the three now seemingly cheap $350 Apple Watch, you're wearing the same exact watch, except for the outside.
As
the guy buying the $17,000 Apple Watch.
I guess that's one way to look at it. That's optimistic.
I feel like that might be.
Oh, completely.
Well, for the pricing, too. If you have a model that's $10,000, suddenly the $350
seems cheap.
Model doesn't seem so expensive, right?
If you had, because, I mean, the most expensive Android Wear watch is only $250 or $300, right?
Right, and Apple's trying to build a luxury fashion brand, and this is what you need to do if you're Bottega Veneta or if you are, any sort of high-end retail name. Stella McCartney, the idea is that you create out-of-reach items that are for a select few, and then you can sell a lot of the more reasonably priced $350 shoes. So you have like a couple of $2,000 pairs or $3,000 pairs of shoes, and then you have a bunch that are like $600 that by comparison feel really reasonable and they're luxury within reach. And that, I'm throwing out these numbers because I was just at Barney's the other day.
Right.
Not shopping for myself, but just sort of this understanding that's the psychology of luxury fashion. And so if Apple wants to play in that game, there's a reason why they hired the woman from Burberry to do this. Like, this is what you need to do.
Isn't it funny because that's exactly, now that you mention it, exactly the same words that people say when they look at haute couture when it's fashion week. Who would pay $30,000 for that dress? It's not about that dress.
No, it's not. It's about what comes down the pipe afterwards. And then exactly to Katie's point, it's about getting from that $10,000 point to that $350 or $550 point. And then on top of that, having the accessories, having the bands, my big thing, I'm definitely getting one and I know what band I want, but I have to make sure that it'll look good on the $350 sports watch. If it looks like it'll clash, then unfortunately my ass is spending $750 on the watch.
Are you going to get the Milanese loop? Come on, admit it.
No. I want the light pink leather. That's what I want. The Milanese loop. No, but wait a minute.
I'm going to get the Milanese loop. Is it tacky? Should I not get it?
No, it's not tacky. It's kind of manly. And I want the light pink. Right. So for you, that'd be perfect. For me,
I don't think I'll wear the light pink.
Yeah, exactly. So for me, I want the light pink and that's the band that I want. And so it's just going to depend whether it clashes with the sport watch, that metal, or if I'm going to have the freaking stainless steel. And everyone that I talk to just says, Christina, come on, you're just going to get you're spending $750 on a watch. You know, this is what's happening. And I'm like, you're right. And the way I'll justify it is I could go, oh, well, the same way I do when I'm at Tory Burch. I'm like, well, it's not as much as this. It's exact same philosophy. He's dead on. That's exactly what they're doing to us. And I am nothing if not a label whore and a consumer and a lover of tech. And so I'm all about it.
So Christina's getting the $10,000.
I think we found our addition buyer. I just want to say this shirt is salmon, not pink.
Salmon. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right?
So Leo, I'm big into the fitness devices.
Yes. And you've worn everyone.
I have. My Twitter profile is, in fact, like a Wonder Woman post. But I have this new one I wanted to show. This is the Garmin Vivo Active. I'm trying to get the screen to show.
It's every bit as attractive as the Basis was, but you like it.
It's super thin, though. It doesn't have any heart rate monitoring on the back, but like it's super thin, and I really like how elegant it is. And I feel like it's a good example of a watch that isn't too manly. So, Christina, you reminded me of that when you were talking about the strap options. But this one's really great. It has GPS, and I haven't charged it since Tuesday, and I took it on a couple of runs. It's still going. I'm like totally impressed with this, and it does notifications too.
Here's her picture, by the way, Jill E. Duffy on Twitter. Every watch.
Yeah.
I want you. I'm going to give you an assignment. Actually, somebody gave me this assignment. I'm passing it on to you to wear the Apple Watch with three or four of the other bands in the same arm so that you can compare the steps and the heart rate and all that stuff.
It, totally get mugged.
How my heart rate goes while I'm
get mugged. Yeah, so you can get mugged, right?
See, I want to go to Chinatown and get. See, I'm not going to spend $10,000 on the rose gold Apple Watch. I'll just go to Chinatown and get one of those for like $50.
Somebody's already selling a Chinese knockoff.
Oh yeah, no, we found one at CES. One of our reporters found one at CES that actually synced with her. That actually paired with her iPhone. But they already had them at CES. She bought one for I think $30 or something.
Crazy.
Yeah, so they're going to be out there, but I'm just looking forward to the rose gold ones in Chinatown.
I used to go to Canal Street. Is that not the place to get $10 watches anymore?
Oh, no, you can go Canal Street. They'll be all over the place there, okay. too. Absolutely.
That's like the edge of Chinatown.
Yeah, it's kind of there.
Exactly. Yeah. It's right there.
Yeah. Our guests today having a fun time, and I didn't want to ghettoize you with the Ellen Pao stuff, but I thought we haven't covered it. We really should cover it at this point. Jill Duffy from PC Magazine, Katie Benner from Bloomberg View, Christina Warren from Mashable. More coming up in a second. If you are saving up for your Apple Watch, whether it's $350 or $7,000 or $10,000 or $17,000, you probably want to know about Gazelle.com. Here's a way you can raise money for your cause by selling your old gadgets. Gazelle will buy your old iPhone, iPad. They even buy broken iPhones and iPads. Samsung Galaxy phones, Microsoft Surface tablets, Nokia phones. They buy a broad variety of gadgets, pay top dollar for it, and they make it easy for you. You can go right now and get a 30-day quote. That quote locked in for 30 days. That means you don't have to decide right now. You can wait until the Galaxy S6 comes out, take a look at it, and then pull the trigger. But that quote is locked in for 30 days, and that's nice. They'll also wipe the data if you forget to do so, so you don't have to worry about it. And they make it easy because they pay the postage on anything worth more than a dollar. So find all those gadgets. They're stuck in drawers and closets and underneath the bed. Pile them all up. Get quotes from Gazelle. When you check out, they'll send you a box to ship it all over to them. They'll turn it around fast and give you a great price. You can get a check, a PayPal credit, or the Amazon gift card. They have now paid out $200 million to many hundreds of thousands of customers, over a million customers. Very happy people. Now, you might wonder, well, what happens to the stuff I sell on Gazelle? Well, they take the best of it, the creme de la creme, and they sell it right to you on Gazelle. Certified pre-owned gadgets. There's two conditions, certified like new and certified good. If you really want to save, get the certified good. They work just great. They just show some gentle signs of wear, kind of probably like the phone you broke or lost that you're replacing. But it's a great way to get a great device at a great price. All devices have been put through a rigorous 30-point inspection. They are 100% fully functional, and there's never any risk. They're all backed by a 30-day risk-free return policy. Gazelle.com to sell or buy, Gazelle. And we thank them so much for their support this week in tech. Tim Cook says he's giving away all his money, but don't get in line. It's to charity. Great Fortune article. Tim Cook worth, they estimate, $785 million. Actually, it's a Reuters article that Fortune republished. And he said he's going to keep a little bit of it to pay for his 10-year-old nephew's college education, and the rest goes to charity. That's pretty sweet.
Kudos. Two thumbs up.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Bill Gates is doing this. He said, I'll give away all but 5% of my fortune. In fact, Gates has joined with Warren Buffett for the Giving Pledge, where billionaires, particularly in the tech industry, pledge to give away at least half their worth in their lifetimes. Mark Zuckerberg's agreed. Larry Ellison of Oracle's agreed. Cook is not in that group, but he said, no, I plan to do it as well. I mean, the real challenge actually is how to do it correctly. It's so easy to just kind of throw money at things. He told Fortune he started donating money to unspecified causes quietly, but he is trying to develop a more systematic approach to philanthropy that goes beyond writing checks. Silicon Valley has not been known for its philanthropy, but I think now things are changing a little bit. In fact, very famously, Steve Jobs was really kind of anti-charity.
Yeah, he really was. Yeah. Although his wife has done quite a bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. She's huge with it, which I think it ends up being his legacy won't be tied to him, but his fortune will probably largely be going to a lot of great philanthropic causes because she's really active.
Tim is also one of the few CEOs who is openly gay. He came out not so long ago, tweeted on Friday condemning the Indiana Religious Freedom Bill. That Religious Freedom Bill allows Indiana businesses to decline to serve gay and lesbian customers. Cook tweeted, Apple's open for everyone. We're deeply disappointed by Indiana's new law, calling on Arkansas governor to veto it. HB.
And you saw that different states In Indiana, they've decided to clarify that law once they realized there was going to be huge blowback from the business community. Well, they figure they have to backtrack somehow and quickly. And I think a lot of that was because of pressure brought to bear by tech companies.
Wasn't it Mark Benioff at Salesforce who said, that's it, we're not going to ever want to have conferences. Yeah. We're never going to have a Salesforce conference in Indiana. Because
they have a big workforce in Indiana because they bought a company that was based in Indiana. So he actually does have some clout there. And it's been interesting to see the way that Benioff has been willing to wield that. And to be honest, he's been one of the few tech CEOs who's come out and said, I think that we should be doing more charitable giving. People are very divided on Mark Benioff about when it comes to his personality and his company. But you have to admit that he's been one of the very few to take a stand on things like social causes, social issues, and philanthropy.
Wow, I got to say right on to that, especially if that carries some weight and has some impact.
So I want to say something a little bit controversial about this.
All right.
I agree with Salesforce. I agree with Tim Cook. I think that they are taking a stand for something that aligns with my values. However, I know that businesses influences state and U.S. law all the time, but it's very disconcerting to me to think about all the times when it doesn't align with my values. So I'm kind of skeptical about what happens when businesses have so much influences that they do change state and federal law. So in this case, like I said, aligns with my values. Of course, I'm very happy about these companies pushing back, but it's a tricky topic, I think.
That's an excellent point, Joe. I mean, what if it went the other way? What if they said, oh, we're not going to do business in Indiana because they have a gay governor? Well, didn't Russia say we're not going to buy any more Apple computers?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of the rub, right? I mean, it can go either way. Yeah. And I think we have to be aware of what that influence means. I think Jill's point is great. But I mean, I think it's kind of a balancing act. We've seen it go that other way for so long. It's at least refreshing to see it go something more progressive and see people speak out in it in that extent. I think it's important to be aware of that and to question what that authority means. But at the same time, I guess maybe I'm just, you know, a bit cynical about it, where I figure it is what it is. Things are going to be influenced regardless. We might as well embrace it when things are actually working towards some more progressive goals, especially in states that have a history of pushing back against anything.
I'm really glad you made that point, Jill, because it's one thing for Tim Cook to say something, to speak out. That's appropriate. It's another thing to I know it's not closing its Indiana Apple stores. We know the Supreme Court has said corporations can act as individuals in this respect.
They're treated as people. Is that the phrase?
Yep.
Right.
But I'm not sure that's always that's a good thing, come to think of it.
I mean, it happens so often that I think it's often invisible and not really discussed anymore. We know that these big companies have a lot of influence. They have lobbyists in Washington. It's something that I think should be troubling on some level.
Yeah. I know I wasn't going to talk about the Apple Watch, but 9 to 5 Mac. Mark Gurman, always on top of these things. He says retail stock will be limited if you walk in the store. Don't count on getting that watch of your dreams. They're saying you should probably April 10th. You'll be able to pre-order April 10th. Online and in store. Gurman's saying it'd probably be smart to order online if you can for April 24th delivery. Just a tip, Christina, if you really want that. But so you want to try it on, don't you?
I guess. Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, that's kind of the problem with this, as opposed to some of their other launches, where you're usually fine with just, you know, pre-ordering sight unseen. But I want to try it on, and I want to see, okay, could I get away with the cheaper, you know, sport watch frame with the band that I want, or do I really need to do what everyone and their brother knows I'm going to do, including my own mother, and spend the $750? Even my own mother is like, Christina, what are you even talking about? Of course you're getting the Apple Watch.
But wait a minute, would get the $750 watch with the pink sport band.
Well, it's $750 including the pink sport band, or it would be $350 for the basic watch with the leather band. Rather, it'd be $350 for the basic sport watch, and then another $250 for the band on top of it. But I need to make sure the band won't clash with the sport backing. Otherwise, I'm just going full hog and spending $750 and getting the watch and the pink band.
Christina, dare I say you're overthinking this? Maybe not.
No, I'm not.
It's a good point, though. I mean, this is a good point about wearables in general and women and women's needs, right? So we can do with some internet shopping, we can do with getting items sent to us and we try them on when they arrive. Often we know the brands and how they fit. But there is a concern that we want to try stuff on. Yeah. We want to make sure that a watch is not too big. We want to make sure that the colors are right. Exactly. And I don't know what Apple's return policy is. I don't know, Christina, if you could order the watch you want and swap it out for something different.
Oh, I'm sure they would let me do that. Sure that'd be fine. But part of the whole thing with this is that they're supposed to be setting up, you know, ways where you can try this on and look at the different bands and look at the different materials. And they're making it, you know, like going to Burberry and trying on, rain jackets, or going to Tory Burch and trying on shoes. I think that it makes sense they'll have more limited stock, but it's going to be slightly different for some of us than the typical Apple experience, because if so much of this really is about the experiential part of this, it doesn't lend itself quite as easily to buying online like you would with a right. Fitbit or something like that.
Well, thank goodness for mixyourwatch.com. Have you seen this?
I have.
So you can pick the watch you wish. You're thinking aluminum. And you want you're not going with a fluoro elastomer, aka rubber band.
No.
You want leather.
I want the light pink.
The classic buckle.
Exactly.
Oh, that's pricey, isn't it? Isn't the buckle gold?
Oh, no, that's not the light pink. That's the salmon color. That one is, yes.
I'm a man. Pricey. I don't know the difference here.
Yeah, no, that one that you have, that particular, that would be my dream pick. That's beautiful, but that's only available.
$7,000 band.
I know. You can only get the band with the Apple Watch edition.
Oh. Well, this site sucks because they don't have the pink leather.
Yeah, they do. It's on the classic buckle. It's the far right on classic buckle, right far. There.
This one.
See, that's light. Yeah, that's light pink.
That's pink.
Yeah.
Looks like white to me. See, little do I know. That's light pink. That's the one you want.
That's the one I want.
And that's going to look good on your wrist. I think
that's really
nice.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I go for that.
Yes.
We all support this purchase.
Shopping.
Work on your Amex.
Do we know? Will all the bands work on all the watches?
Yes, they will.
So it's the same attachment thing on all of them.
Attachment thing. They didn't make that clear, I had to call Apple to confirm that. But yes, they all will work with all of them. So now it's just, now will they all match? Not necessarily. You know, you wouldn't necessarily want that Milanese band with the gold watch, but they will all work together.
Wait a minute. Let me just look at the Milanese. Oh, yeah, you're right. That would be terrible. Horrible. No good. Very bad. So I'm going to, you think, can it work with the aluminum? Yeah, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It probably would look quite good with the aluminum.
I think it would.
I've been debating with my fashion friends on Twitter about this. It's the few times where fashion Twitter and tech Twitter overlap is with picking out the right Apple Watch band assortment. But I need to see this in person. This is really what it comes down to.
Good news. You'll be able to make 15-minute appointments. This, by the way, 15 minutes is only for you buying the steel and aluminum. Those of you buying the gold will... call your broker. I don't know. It's just some other. Is there some other system? You can make these appointments ahead of time. You can try it as walk-in, but there'll be limited accessibility. You really should book ahead online an appointment starting April 10th. They say the watch edition appointments could last up to 30 minutes. But one source has told Mark Gurman, it's not like we'll kick out the sport and stainless steel customers if they're taking too long. And I guarantee you, if you're looking at a $17,000 watch, you could take all the time you want.
Yes.
I'm going to order online for April 24th delivery. There is not the in-store pickup that we've seen before with iPads and iPhones. You will not be able to, apparently, according to a 9-to-5, you won't be able to go into the store and pick it up. But that may change as inventory becomes more available. So just a little planning.
I wonder how they're going to ensure if anybody actually tries to order the $10,000 watch online. Like, how are they going to ensure that? Because I think
Tim Cook will come to your house.
I would hope so.
With a briefcase and a manacle.
But like, all jokes aside, I mean, like, don't you think that somebody from FedEx or UPS, I mean, I don't know if, you know what I mean? Like, if you've got one of those delivery guys and they've got, you know, one of these watch editions, I don't know. I mean,
how do they do it if you order a Patek Philippe in the mail? Can you mail order an expensive? You must be able to, right?
I don't even know.
I don't know.
I don't think this is the crowd.
You can buy
be
extended insurance on shipping. That's not a problem.
And they make you sign, and it's in a plain brown wrapper.
Didn't that happen? happened when the iPhone, I want to say the iPhone 5 came out, or maybe the 5S. There was this rash of like people's phones not showing up at their doorstep, and they were getting stolen. The delivery drivers were stealing them. Yeah.
Wow.
That's what I'm saying. That totally was a real thing that happened. And that's why I'm asking. I'm thinking with the watches, you're on the off chance that somebody might have actually been dumb enough to order a $10,000 watch through the mail. I mean, to me, I figure if you've got that much money, go into the store and get your ass kissed. That's part of the fun of spending that much money.
I think you're right.
I don't know.
I think you're right.
When Google Glass came out, I know there was an option that you can go and pick it up at certain locations.
Right. And they,
but if you just ordered it, did they ship it to you?
Yeah. But I think that they wanted you to, especially early on when people cared, they wanted you to come in and they'd fit it to you. And they had this whole retail experience.
I guess that's, you know, a tenth of the price or so.
Yeah, exactly. $1,500. That's nothing.
Yeah.
You don't deserve anything.
Again, that economic view of something looking less expensive.
Well, somebody said this, probably Renee Ritchie on MacBreak Weekly this week, but the market in this market, the high-end $10,000 to $17,000 watch market, you're not, the people who are buying that are, it's about the experience. It isn't about the thing. They want to be cosseted. They want to come in and have a cup of tea and, you know, people fawn over. That's part of the whole process. Yeah. That's why you do
that. Well, I think Katie and Christina were both saying before, I mean, this is part of Apple's strategy of becoming a lifestyle brand, right? Like, it's not just about fashion. It's about that whole experience. And they've been on this track for at least a decade. And the Apple Store is just a wonderful example of that. So I think the Apple Store, I was reading about it recently. It was modeled after very nicely designed hotels that have high-end clientele. And whenever you survey the high-end clientele, they said, we love the concierge. Like, that's the best experience of going to a great hotel. You go up to this person, they take care of things for you. They're very quick. They're very efficient. They're very knowledgeable. And that's how Apple developed the Genius Bar. So it's taking, you know, some idea that's already existed and sort of repurposing it into what we call the tech world. But it's really the retail world. It's really the fashion world. It's a number of things.
Don't you feel like Steve Jobs is just spinning in his grave, though? I mean, I've been reading. You don't think so, really? I've been reading the new book about him becoming Steve Jobs, which is I don't know if there's anything new in it, but it's a good read. I like reading about Steve. I feel like he was a hippie. He
was a hippie who evolved, like most hippies did, into a yuppie, right? I mean, isn't that kind of what happened?
He liked
driving
an expensive Mercedes. He really liked, high quality product. So maybe
he liked winning. And I think more than anything, he liked,
that's true,
you know, being the best company, most profitable company, biggest company in the world.
God, but so Apple was really an issue. Maybe I'm wrong, because I'm a pie-eyed Apple fanboy. But in the early days, when I was really an Apple fan, it was the company for the rest of us. It wasn't about – it was about humans and using computing to change the world. Isn't that what he told John Sculley, who was a marketing executive at Pepsi, when he tried to hire him? He said, you could continue to sell sugar water to the masses, or you can come here and change the world.
Sure, but look at Google. I mean, their slogan used to be, don't do evil. Everybody changes once they become huge multi-billion-dollar companies with enormous market caps that all the largest investment firms in the world own pieces of, and that, you know, our retirements are built upon. We need that stock to go up. So, yeah, I think that once companies get really large, that stuff goes away.
Did anybody have you read that book, or is that on your...
Yeah, and I've read it.
I finished it
this week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Because I took most of the week off for Bob's Burgers Live, and so I read it.
Wait a minute. Slow down. You took the week off to go down to Washington, D.C. for the live?
I took the week off. I took 3 days off. Yes,
wow.
I did.
That's commitment.
It is commitment, and it was for my husband's birthday, belated birthday. It was a trip for that, and so I read it on the Amtrak. It was a good book, but I think that the K is absolutely right. He liked to win, but also, I mean, you could make the argument that you have a much better shot at changing the world with something like an iPhone or an iPad than you do with, you know, kind of a hobbyist computer kit. You know, I mean, if you really think about how Apple has kind of changed the world, a lot of times it's with these more mass products. Now, that's not to say that a watch is going to change the world, but I don't think that it has to be either or. I think you can be both more consumer and kind of, you know, I guess not consumer is the right word, I guess more commercially focused, and also have an impact to really change the way everything's going to work.
Well, if you're Pebble Watch, you've done both.
Yeah, that's true. I'm getting one of those too.
Pebble Watch closed its Kickstarter campaign for the Pebble Time on Friday. They wanted, maybe $500,000. They got $20 million.
So good.
30 days. Pebble Time is color.
Yep.
7 days battery life, a new interface. And, of course, Pebble's the only watch that works on both iOS and Android. $20 million, 78,000 backers. But the thing that bothers me a little bit about this is it sort of turns Kickstarter into a store. This was really about, hey, pre-order, not raise money so we can develop something cool.
Well, it's both, right? Because I think that they're a special case. They're kind of the exception that proves the rule. You know, they even were very upfront when I talked to them when they announced their Kickstarter that they had the lines ready to go, that this was more one of those things to kind of go back to the community and let them get in on it early, be the first people to get the watch. You know, since they built their company truly on Kickstarter.
Right.
And I think they're one of the few companies that can say they genuinely, like, VCs turned them down. You know, Eric was not able to get VCs interested in them. And then they raised, you know, almost $10 million in Kickstarter last time and finally had people paying attention to them. And they managed to ship a product. So I think that, yeah, I mean, it kind of turns it into a store. But at the same time, I think that this is one of those few times where, you know, people get mad about how Kickstarter is being kind of, you know, taken over by the rich and the powerful. And I guess that's true, but I was interviewing people who were some of the first successful Kickstarter people, you know, more than 4 years ago, who the ones that were really successful were people who had connections already in manufacturing and who knew what they were doing and who were basically using the platform as much for marketing as for seed funding. And it's really about being able to kind of do with the money what you want without being beholden to other people. So, I mean, in this case, it does kind of turn it into a store in a sense, but I also feel like the community is okay with it because this is like the ultimate Kickstarter success story. So why not, you know, come back and double the amount of money they're doing? And granted, you know, they have funding and they're doing well, but they're going up against humongous behemoths, you know, known as Google, known as Apple. So $20 million and 78,000 watches is fantastic. But let's not pretend that that's going to even be a dent in what Apple's going to do in their first hour of pre-orders.
I'm really curious, Christina, why do you think it is that we are seeing all of these hardware companies continue to put out wristbands? I mean, Jawbone's trying. They still haven't gotten theirs out. Who knows what's going on there? But Pebble and Shine, you know, companies, Fitbit, they still really believe that there's a place in the market for them. And I have not been able to figure out why that is.
Jill Duffy's the queen of these things.
I
got a Basis watch because of you, Jill Duffy.
How do you like it? How do you like
it's in the drawer with my Nike Fuel Band and my Jawbone up. And
Okay, so this is where I think these devices are going. Part of what they do well is they allow us to have a Generation 1 device in our pockets or on our bodies that's collecting a lot of data from a lot of people that could effectively be used in health and wellness. So there's kind of two angles to this. One is the mass collection of data. Everybody's a little scared of that term. But if you think about research trials for things in medicine and health studies, we're often looking at like 1,000, 2,000 people over a very short amount of time, like maybe a year or two if we're lucky. So you start to have devices like these that are collecting actual data. It's not self-reported. You can have user groups that are in the tens of thousands rather than 1 or 2,000. Suddenly, you have a lot of data to work with in research and medicine, which we've never had before. So when you look at devices like Fitbits and Jawbone Ups and things like this, Misfit Shine, they're pretty limited in what they can do. But we have to remember, these are Generation 1 devices. So they're looking at our activity and our sleep, how much we walk, how much we move, how fast we move, things like that. Well, let's imagine now a Generation 2 and a Generation 3 device that can see exactly what we're eating and how many calories we're burning, our heart rate, our respiratory rate, our heart rate variability. Now we have a much richer data set that we can use to track people's health and come up with really interesting correlations about health and wellness. I think that's where it's eventually really, really going. There's a couple of companies in the health sphere that are already doing this. There's a device called the Health Patch. It started out as something being used in hospitals. It's a little patch that you wear on your chest. It measures the same kind of things that Fitbits do, how much you walk, It has fall detection, which is just really a motion sensor, heart rate, breathing rate, things like that. It also measures stress. So it takes some of the other data points that it has. It puts them into a stress algorithm and it measures your stress. So what it did was it allowed hospitals who had patients post-surgery or something like that, they didn't really need to be in the hospital anymore. The doctors wanted to send them out, but the hospital really wanted to continue monitoring their vital signs. So with a health patch, you stick this thing on a person, you send them on their way, and the doctors still get a notification if something changes that we need to have some medical intervention about.
Does this tie to a phone? What is? It must be Bluetooth to a phone, no?
Yeah, it does have Bluetooth. I think it's going to a mobile phone. I think it can also go through a HIPAA-compliant network via Wi-Fi.
See, that's part of the issue. Now, I notice they have FDA approval, and I know that Apple did not get FDA approval for similar capabilities in the Apple Watch. I wonder if that's the point of research, Kit, is to get...
Remember that this is Generation 1 stuff. I mean, this takes years and years and years to develop and get it right. I think the tech industry has going for it innovation, right? Like the push to do things faster. And anytime I've talked to companies who are working in health, they say like, oh, the FDA, they have really strict rules and regulations in the United States.
Appropriately so.
Yes, exactly. But they have to clear those hurdles. They have to clear them well. And it's, I think... In my lifetime, we're definitely going to see some really wonderful things happening. So the second point that I didn't really talk about. So one is this mass collection of data. The second point is if we have lots of data about ourselves, we can have what people are calling more personalized medicine. And often it's preventative. So let's say that in the last 5 years, I've tracked pretty much everything I've eaten, or at least a representative amount of food that I've eaten to get a sense of what I have day by day, the nutritional information that I, you know, consume, how much I walk, how much I move, how fast I move, what kind of intervals I do, what my heart rate does, how much sleep I get. And now based on that, if I can get personalized information about what to do to, say, lower the chances that I'm going to develop arthritis in 20 years, that's going to be really amazing. So it's that preventative stuff that's very personalized because we have specific data about you rather than data about 2,000 people. Right. And we sort of know what happens with 2,000 people who follow X, Y, and Z. So I think, again, like, I think that's why companies like Fitbit and Jawbone know that this is going to go somewhere else.
I agree with you. I think you nailed it because all health advice is based on a statistical model. Your chances are. But once it becomes personalized in that way, I think it could be so much more accurate. We've talked about personal cancer drugs, for instance. Drugs that analyze the genome of your cancer, and instead of kind of mass and very dangerous chemotherapy targeting that particular cancer with an appropriate drug.
Will the Fitbits and Jawbones of the world survive, I guess, is my question. You know, what I'm curious as to why these companies keep on putting, you know, they put out products and they are...
Well, they're not going to give up and go home.
But, you know, so what is their, you know, what is their plan going forward? What do you think they should be doing at this point now that the Samsungs, the Googles and the Apples of the world are all encroaching on their space? Should they be partnering or trying to get acquired? I'm really genuinely curious because there are a lot of, this is a crowded industry.
Super crowded.
Jill, you're the expert.
I think there may be some acquisitions, but I think they're also like some of the companies that are making smart watches are definitely learning from the companies that are making the health and fitness devices and vice versa. So that Garmin watch that I showed you earlier, it does smart notifications. Like it works with iOS, it works with Android. You can get whatever notifications you want from your phone onto your wrist. So Garmin knows people want that. People are interested in it. But Garmin has been doing this for a long, long time. With runner's watches. So they're actually a very established company in the sense of knowing how to do the technology for measuring, not usually step count, that's something that's been newer to them, but your pace and your speed and your mileage when you run or bicycle or do any number of activities. I think right now we're still in the point where it's seen as a hobby, right? So that's... When that starts to change, I think that's when the market's really going to shake up with either acquisitions or companies starting to partner with insurance companies and healthcare companies and places like that.
I feel like, to answer your question, Katie, it's always foolish in technology to assume, oh, here comes Apple or Samsung or Google. We might as well just give up. you just don't know where the winner's going to come from.
It's true.
And but you ask a very important question, which is where should you focus to attempt to become that winner? And I'm sure the fact that there's a diversity of choices, I don't think it's going to come from a company, frankly, like Garmin, because they've been around too long. I think it's going to be an innovation out of nowhere. But who knows, right? That's what's exciting about covering technology. Garmin's doing an interesting thing because they're a GPS, and this is where they have a disadvantage. See, they're an incumbent. They have a business. They're a GPS company. Well, we'll put the GPS in the watch. And Apple says, well, why should we put the GPS in the watch? You already have it in your phone.
Right.
We need to tie the watch to the phone.
Runners
don't want to carry a phone. I know.
Yeah.
But that's one small group that's runners.
I was going to say, that's one niche. I have to wonder for regular people. Like, I love my Fitbit. I love it. My mom loves her Fitbit. But I have to wonder if I'm going to be using my Fitbit after I get my Apple Watch. If I'm being honest, I'm probably not.
Sure, because it can be smarter because it ties to a huge computer in your pocket.
Well, and usually, you know, my Fitbit, I've got my phone with me anyway. And so, you know, it's kind of doing that wireless syncing stuff anyway. So, I mean, I wear a Pebble and I like it. It doesn't do all the, you know, health and fitness stuff I would want to do. But if I can basically get everything in my Fitbit, my Apple Watch, I kind of don't know why I would bother wearing the Fitbit as well. I mean, maybe if I was just doing a dedicated run and I didn't want to have a phone with me. But otherwise, I think for a lot of people, the activity tracker market disappears if you buy into the idea that most of us will be wearing smartwatches. And that may or may not be true. But I do wonder, I mean, but obviously those two worlds are blurring so much that I think that outside of certain niches, it does become a thing where they kind of overlap to the point that you don't need both.
And wouldn't it preserve you if you perhaps worked with HealthKit? And so now you're going to be a specific sensor for a larger ecosystem of sensors. Apple will get involved, but you still can survive as an individual. Maybe that's the way.
Yeah, Apple Health is just not great. Like, let's acknowledge that first of all. It is not great. It's very difficult to use. It's very confusing. Fitbit does integrate with a lot of other devices and apps. And I think that's part of, right now for me anyway, part of the decision factor about which device somebody might want to buy. The other thing, of course, is price. So if you already have a smartphone, which most people do, you can spend $350 to $10,000 on an Apple Watch. Or maybe if all you really want is something that's going to track your runs, track your walking every day, you can find a device for $99 that's going to do that. That's a much more attractive option. So I like having a lot of options. And it kind of reminds me, actually, before the show started, Leo, you were talking about Meerkat.
Right.
And like, oh, it doesn't have all the features. You can't save your videos locally. Well, I think what Meerkat is doing, which is kind of similar to what we were just talking about, is they're offering one set of options, right? So there are people who say, okay, the kind of live streaming that I'm doing, I don't want to save those videos. I see this as an ephemeral experience. I see this as a here and now, quick and dirty, sort of the thrill of the moment, right? So I don't want those other features. And I like when the landscape of a particular tech device or service plays out like that, where people have lots of options and not everybody's offering the same exact feature package.
It's funny that you should say that, because one of the reasons we were talking about Meerkat, we just concluded an interview with its founder, Ben Rubin, which will be on tomorrow's Triangulation. And that's exactly what he said. He said, there are all these verticals. We're in one vertical, the stream, he had a name for it, but that's just one of many, and there will be many. And he welcomed a variety of apps in this domain of live streaming, because there's many different ways to do it. And you're right. Some people don't want it to be preserved. Do watch that interview. It was great with Ben Rubin. That'll be on tomorrow's Triangulation. All right, Talkin' Barbie coming up in just a second. We're having a lot of fun. The panel today, Jill Duffy from PC Mag, Jill E. Duffy on Twitter, Katie Benner from Bloomberg View, and Christina Warren from Mashable. Great to have all three of you on. Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting from Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients in the convenience of your computer or your smartphone or your tablet. It's kind of like Meerkat for business, really. Share the same screen, see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. You don't need to travel anymore to hold a meeting. You can use your iPad, you can use your iPhone, your Android device to meet clients, to meet coworkers online. It's so great to start a meeting. It's so easy to start a meeting. And then you have the capability. You can share your screen. You can hear the audio in the and from the computer, the microphone on the tablet. If you want to see each other, you just almost everything that has a webcam, you just turn it on. HD quality, it looks fabulous. It's flexible, it's easy, and you don't have to, if you want a client, for instance, you're going to make a presentation to a client, you don't have to make them jump through hoops. They don't have to have a GoToMeeting account or anything. They click the link. It's easy to create an email. They click the link. The software downloads in just, you know, about 30 seconds, and suddenly they're seeing you. They're seeing your PowerPoint presentation. It's really kind of amazing. A great way to get work done in business, and I want you to try it today for 30 days free. All you have to do is visit GoToMeeting.com and click that Try It Free button. If I had my choice, I wouldn't have any. I would only have GoToMeetings. I wouldn't have any in-person meetings anymore at all. Just, it's so much easier. It's so fast. You get the job done. GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. 30 days free. GoToMeeting from Citrix. So a couple of weeks ago, actually more like a few months ago, I interviewed a guy named Oren Jacob. He is at Toy Talk, and they have a really interesting iPad app. Actually, they have several of them. That their experience has been that toddlers are now interacting with their iPad in a very interesting way. These apps have characters on screen, cartoon characters, who ask open-ended questions of the toddler, and then the toddler responds. It's kind of like Eliza, and then the conversation continues. They have on their website some editor's picks. They've got parental permission to put these on their website at toytalk.com. Here's an example of a character.
It feels so good to sing sometimes, doesn't it? Now, come on, you listen patiently to me. Now you sing something.
So that's a Loch Ness Monster character on the screen. I can't pause it, but I'll let it go through again. That is asking the child to sing and listen to what happens.
Well, here it goes. You need the friend, you need the friend. I will help you out if you try.
So the kid,
to help me out
now these are recordings that
I'll help you out as much as I can. You need the friend, you need your friend, you need
I've talked
friend.
To parents who use this software on their iPad. They said the kid takes it, goes off in a corner, and is like talking to the iPad. Here's another one.
You cannot just fall in love. But that you can also fall out of love, like it is a nest or the mouth of a jungle predator. And she says that I am having to think of ways to keep our love from falling out of her heart, or her heart from
heavy duty
falling
stuff.
Out of... It's all very confusing, zookeeper. Please, tell me what I must do so that nobody falls out of love.
For a five-year-old.
Well, you must be very kind to her. And bring her gifts now and then. And remember her important dates. Like,
this is a kid. So the reason I bring this up, New York Times article today in the Sunday Times, Toy Talk is creating a Barbie that will talk back to kids. There's Oren Jacob right there. Fascinating. What they're saying is that kids today, not high school kids, younger kids, are used to talking to their gadgets and them talking back. This is part of how they have grown up. So for them, the idea of a Barbie that can have a conversation, this is not a pull the string, feed me, Barbie. This is a Barbie that will have a conversation like Siri will. It will analyze the speech and produce relevant responses. Hello, Barbie is a Wi-Fi-enabled Barbie, which comes out this fall. What do you think?
I love it and I hate it. On the one hand, I love it. No, hear me out. So on the one hand, I really like it because I think that it makes sense for the way kids play with toys, right? They talk to them and they have these conversations.
Right.
And to be able to have a toy and have this smart interactivity where you can get intelligent things back, I would have loved this as a kid. I think that's awesome. The thing that concerns me, and I know this is a weird thing, but in their privacy policy, basically because they record the data, the parents have permission to go through and listen to everything that the kid has told.
And by the way, that's where we get these recordings from, is their parents.
Right.
Yeah.
And exactly. And I don't know. There's something creepy to me about the fact that if I'm a kid and I'm talking to my toy, that my parents could be spying on me and listening to what I'm saying. I mean, on the one hand, I understand you want things for safety and precaution. But on the other hand, like, sometimes kids talk to their toys about things they might not want to talk to their parents about. And I don't know. I'm thinking back to me, if I were a little girl, if I would have wanted my parents to know everything I did with my Barbie dolls. To be perfectly honest, no, I wouldn't have wanted them to know.
Didn't you, with your Barbie dolls, have conversations? You would talk to them, but Barbie would talk to Ken.
I'd create entire soap operas. I would recreate Morrow's plays with my Barbie dolls all the time. I would recreate The Young and the Restless and Melrose Place with my Barbie dolls and would have full conversations and love triangles, the whole works. I don't know if I would have wanted my parents to know
that
what I was doing at 9 years old was, you know, making my Barbie dolls have sex with each other and steal each other's boyfriends. I don't know if I would want that to be, I'm just being honest, I don't know if I would
I'm
be
comfortable
with that.
I'm glad they know now.
Well, they don't care now, but you know, but at the time,
at
you
the
know.
At the time, they would have freaked out.
Exactly. And it was just like healthy expression of me, you know, living out my goal of being a TV writer or something. And so I don't know. I love it, but I am a little concerned with the privacy policy, which I know they're doing for the right reasons. But I'm kind of concerned with the idea that the parents can just kind of listen to everything their kids are doing with their toys. To me, that kind of, I don't know, that's my only qualm with
can
it.
Can I just say, as a parent, we would often sneak into the room and listen anyway.
That's a good point.
We just didn't have the capabilities that modern technology gives us to bug our children 24/7. Here's Hello Barbie. Now, one thing, Barbie's been in trouble before for saying things like math is hard. Let's hope that they've gone beyond that.
I love New York, don't you? Tell me,
hey.
What's your favorite part about the city? The food, the fashion, or the sight?
Food, fashion, or sight?
Food.
We like the food in the restaurants.
Wow, so this Barbie is working for the New York City Tourism Board.
Seriously.
What's your favorite food?
So not every kid, this is not appropriate for every kid, but there are kids who have difficulty communicating.
I think that this could be successful, and I'm sure there'll be kids
sure,
who love
be.
It. But it sort of falls into that uncanny valley territory where things are just a little bit off, but you don't know why. I mean, we had like Simon Says. Is that what that thing was called?
Yeah.
We've had toys that have talked before. And at the end of the day, for most kids, the great thing about being a kid is your imagination is really rich. And so your playtime is much more interesting and exciting with like inanimate stuffed animals and stuff.
That's
because
actually very
you can
true.
Really, because my mom runs a daycare center. So I've watched little kids a lot and the way they play. And they'll play with a machine for a while, and it's great. But the most interesting conversations they have, and the ones where you see them really engrossed, is when they're using their imaginations to make up scenarios that they control and that they have fun with, whether it's alone or with friends or with toys. So,
let me quote Natasha Singer's article in the New York Times. A recent study conducted by researchers at Georgetown compared two groups of toddlers. One group played with plush toys that had been pre-programmed to say the child's name, and to say that they had the same favorite food and song as the child. The other played with plush toys that called each child pal. Hey, Pally! And they liked different things. With the same toy character on screen presented math skills. So they had the character then on screen presenting math skills like arranging cups in order of size. The first group of toddlers, the ones addressed by name, performed better than those addressed as pal.
Sure.
That's hilarious. My sister used to think that Mr. Rogers was talking directly to her. She thought that she was his television friend. She thought that he was actually talking directly to her through the television.
That was actually the secret. I think one of the secrets to his success was he looked right at the camera and said, "Hey, friend, how are you today?"
She literally thought that she was his television friend, that he was talking just to her. And I think it was probably once she discovered that reruns were a thing that she figured out.
Wait a minute. He said the same thing last week.
Right. I was never under any illusions that it was not television, but I did think Big Bird was human because he slept in a bed. So that was my thing is that I thought, well, of course, if he's sleeping in a bed, then he must be a real human. But no, I mean, I think that there is something to be said for having this personalization. But I think Katie's point is great. My mom's a child psychologist. She's retired now. And yeah, the way kids play with things, and I've observed a little bit of that. Yeah, they tend to be a lot more verbal and get a lot more of their playthings done when they can create the stories. But when it comes to learning things, that's, I think, maybe where it's different. If you can customize it and personalize it more, the kid might be more engaged and more willing to go through the exercises and retain what's happening if they feel like they're part of it, rather than just, hiya, Sonny, hiya, pal.
You know, pal is not a good choice.
Pal is probably not a good choice.
Hey, Pally, how you doing? A couple of weeks ago, the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, an advocacy group in Boston, asked Mattel to shelve Talking Barbie, saying the voice recordings amounted to eavesdropping and could be used to exploit the intimate feelings of children. Whatever the child says will be manipulated and used to insinuate these dolls further into girls' lives, said Susan Lynn, the group's director. So, anyway, What hath technology wrought? At least Barbie can be a computer engineer. Don't get us started.
That book was terrible.
I know, but it was fun to laugh at. All right. Google says it's not giving up on Google Glass. Eric Schmidt says the demise of Glass has been greatly exaggerated.
He's so full of it.
You think?
Yes, I do, completely. If it comes out again, they're not calling it Google Glass, and for one reason only, glass holes.
The glass holes.
The branding alone, if they do come, and I'm not saying that they won't come out with something new in that space and it evolve from it, but you can almost guarantee that it will have brand new branding because the current branding is just toxic.
Now, they brought in Tony Fadell to oversee it. So, I mean, Fadell's, of course, the guy who designed the iPod, went on to design the Nest thermostat, was acquired. His company was acquired by Google. He's now overseeing strategy for Glass. That indicates that Glass is not dead.
No, I'm sure that a lot of people are looking into VR and kind of augmented reality. I mean, if they weren't looking into the space, it would be surprising. But I think that the idea that Glass, the way that it's been presented,
right,
will continue on that level. I mean, I have to think that, I mean, you know, that Tony probably took, and I've only talked to him a couple of times, but I have to think he would take one look at the whole scenario and just go, okay, we're starting over. We're starting over from the drawing board because doesn't work from, you know, a perspective where people are not embracing this. It doesn't look good. It creeps people out. We attracted the wrong type of early adopters. Let's try a completely different approach.
To me, Glass is not a consumer experience. Glass is a brilliant and wonderful industrial device. So when you have it being used on oil rigs or in hospitals,
sure,
or places where people have a limited amount of ability to use their hands, like, it's so brilliant.
It is.
Isn't
HoloLens better than Glass, though, the Microsoft augmented reality?
Maybe.
It could be. I mean, I think
I feel like that's the one I want. Because it can... Yeah. So Glass is really, let's face it, all Glass is a monitor over your eyebrow.
Right.
Right?
But it can be awesome in industrial situations in medicine. Yeah. But in that case, I mean, you have a lot of people who are doing that. Epson's doing some amazing things with that sort of stuff. There are a lot of healthcare companies involved.
But augmented reality, I can look through... I can add a user interface or instructions to what I'm actually looking at. So if I'm on an oil rig and I'm trying to learn how to do something, it can actually show me with a little arrow, turn this knob, push this button. I feel like augmented reality is what Glass should end up being.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, those products are still nascent. So, I mean, what people will want is yet to be seen. The thing that's so funny about the Google announcement is that consumers have already voted. They don't want it.
Yeah, like, that's pretty obvious.
It's over.
It's true.
And everybody I know who spent the money on Glass has put it in a drawer anyway.
Yeah. One of the things I'm interested in that I think Apple Watch actually might be able to do is the sense of adding tactile experiences into our smart devices. So if your Apple Watch could, through a series of like taps and sort of suggestion motions, give you directions so that we're not relying only on our eyes or only on our ears, I think that's the more interesting use.
I think it's going to do
that.
It's
a little bit
isn't
less invasive too. Like, people don't want to wear Glass on their face, and you don't want to be staring at a phone all the time, and you don't want to have, you know, headphones on all the time. Like, I think there are more ways to incorporate smart information that we're just not quite taking advantage of yet.
It's a specialized use, but it was a really eye-opener when I was wearing Android Wear and we were in London and I had asked my phone for directions somewhere, and then the Wear watch takes over and shows you. It even buzzes you when it's time to turn. So it shows you where you are, says turn left here. That is incredible.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the great use cases for a watch. And that's how I've actually gotten people excited. It's funny you say that about the idea of the Apple Watch or smartwatches in general. It's when I tell them about, I use my Pebble the same way, you know, for directions, finding, you know, nearby train stops or buzzing when to turn. And I think the Glass, actually, that was my favorite part of using Glass, was for any of the direction things, kind of the overlay. So we'll see.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I still want to do the FTC story about Google, and we have to talk about F8, Facebook's developer conference, which, I don't know, felt like kind of a dud, but maybe you found some wonderful things, little gems in there. Christina Warren from Mashable is here, Katie Benner from Bloomberg View, and from PC Magazine, Jill Duffy. Great to have all three of you here today. I have been playing with my Little Bits, and I've got to say, it's fabulous. So glad to see Little Bits again. We were talking a lot about it during the holidays. Perfect Christmas gift for people with kids. And, you know, one of the things I think is so important, as consumers of electronics, as consumers of technology, to kind of get kids turned on to the idea that they can do it too, that they can be makers. But sometimes, especially for little fingers, things like soldering, that's a little scary. Little Bits is so cool. It's taking electronics design and creation out of the hands of experts and giving it to everyone, for kids, even for parents, for kids at heart, for coders, hardware hackers. With Little Bits, you could do anything. Get your dog to send a text or make a robotic snack server. And the nice thing is it's so simple. There's no soldering involved. This is a Little Bits kit. We've made a few. Last time we had them on, I actually made a Little Bits. Ooh, we got a good one this time. Ooh, look at all the Little Bits here. These all snap together magnetically, so there's no soldering involved. There's components. There's over 60 components to do a huge variety of projects. The Little Bits kit will come, of course, with instructions and a project guide. Connect battery and cable to the blue module. Turn it on. Pink modules affect modules after them. Green modules are do something in the physical world, and then give you some great projects. If you've been thinking, I want to get an electronic, I remember Heathkit as a, you know, I'm an old guy. I remember Heathkit, and I just think teaching kids how this stuff works, put it together, to teach them things about logic, about mechanical interaction, is so great. They enjoy it. It's better than a Lego, an Erector set. It's building something that really, really works. There are a variety of Little Bits kits. There's the base kit or the deluxe kit. I think this is the this must be the deluxe kit. This is so great here. Great way to get started. The space kit was developed in partnership with NASA. So they've got Earth and Space Science. There's an Arduino coding kit that lets you code the Arduino. So if you want a child to get started in programming, I'll tell you, programming is so abstract. It's really great to have a physical output. It is a great way to learn. For the Tinkerer, the deluxe kit includes 18 modules that snap together with billions of circuits possible. No wiring, no soldering. You can make it in seconds. There's a synth kit if you're into music. It's a modular analog. Oh, I love this idea. Modular analog synthesizer. Oscillators, filter, envelope, keyboard, microsequence. See, if you have a kid who's interested in music, as Henry is, and he's used Logic, but this is the best way to teach him what this stuff is actually doing. Little Bits is now offering customers $20 off your first kit. Go to Little Bits, LittleBits, Little Bits, no cutesy spelling on this, .com/twit. You'll get free shipping in the U.S. as well. And after you make something, send an Instagram off to Little Bits. I know we'd love to see it. Just at Mr_Laporte. I'll pass it along. I'd love to see your Little Bits creation. Little Bits, it's so cool. Don't you? I don't know. You guys are young. Maybe you had something like this when you were young. I would have loved this.
I would have loved this.
Isn't this awesome? It's like a chemistry set. So fun. Have you played with this, Christina?
I have not. But I love it. I love that.
Isn't it great?
The fact they have the Arduino kit, like that's just awesome.
Yeah.
Like the fact that just I would have gone crazy for this as a kid.
And if you want to see more, there's littlebits.cc/upload, where you can see what people are creating. And there's some great tips. They've really made a community. I remember when this started, it was a Kickstarter. Pretty sure it was a Kickstarter. And I invested at the very beginning, and it was just getting started. This is like, there's so much stuff now. It's such a rich experience. They say for ages 8 to infinity, but I think if you're an adult and you have a younger, smart kid, this would be fine for a 6-year-old even. This is just incredible. This is the deluxe kit, 18 bits modules, 5 million combinations, 15 projects. A great way to start. $20 off at littlebits.com/twit. I think this is so cool. A drinker bot. What does it do? It's a robotic drink mixer. What?
That's what? Awesome.
For all your Shirley Temples.
Oh, my goodness. Sometimes people, I love the creativity of human beings, I got to say. Just fabulous. Did any of you watch Zuckerberg or the others at F8? We streamed the keynotes. We got up early, streamed it on Wednesday and Thursday. And I just felt like there was nothing new.
What about the platform stuff? I mean, any of you think that was interesting at all?
Say again, Katie?
The Internet of Things platform stuff that they're doing with Parse. Is that something that you guys find interesting? It's such a huge trend. I don't really see how it fits in naturally with what Facebook does, but they
well, it is it is interesting. I mean, they've acquired Oculus Rift. Internet of Things is more of the same kind of. They almost feel like these are googly kind of moonshot things.
Yeah, I mean, I love Parse, and I think that was interesting. I think as a way to kind of extend that, I think
what is Parse?
Parse is kind of their application, a kind of a services framework that lets people automate a lot of web apps and take care of a lot of details. That they bought them a couple of years ago, and tons of different applications that aren't based on Facebook in any way use Parse
as
kind of the backend stuff. And so by adding into kind of this Internet of Things stuff, it could kind of be a way to maybe help, you know, people build more IoT style support into their apps. I think that was interesting. Whether I don't know how they turn that into anything of their core business, but it's certainly interesting.
It does feel like Facebook is trying to, just like Google is trying to reinvent itself constantly. You need to in this day and age. There's always the risk that somebody's going to come. They're going to be MySpaced if that's all they did, right?
That's true. It was interesting to me kind of comparing this F8 to last F8, like how much things they announced last year didn't work. Like, remember App Links? We all thought that was going to be, or they sold that. Like, it was in 1,000 apps. I mean, so that was a complete fail. I thought their new ad platform thing with they're going to be doing for mobile apps could potentially be disruptive. But yeah, I mean, there was, it's kind of a, nothing that interesting, I guess, to regular consumers. And a lot of developers
Which is worse, announcing a bunch of stuff that doesn't happen, doesn't work, doesn't go anywhere, or just kind of saying, well, try Parse.
That's true.
That was like, they didn't. So one of the things they are changing, they're going to try to make Messenger. I think this is a total non-starter. Messenger, a platform. They want developers to write apps that integrate with Facebook Messenger. And they showed a couple of dumb apps that allow you to do, you know, kind of weird things in Facebook Messenger. It's not compelling to me. And I wonder why anybody would even develop. They do have 40 developers who have apps. Like, they showed Jib Jab, so you can make a little Jib Jab video and then send it in Messenger. I can't imagine why anybody would spend any energy building on Facebook's platform at this point. And yet they're doing just fine. It's not like Facebook's in trouble or anything. Their stock price continues to go up. Nothing. This is exactly my reaction to F8. How about the Oculus Rift? Is this in good hands? Are they a good steward of virtual reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they bought it with the understanding that this is going to be a long-term play and that they don't need to, I mean, they're still showing off the same Crescent Bay demo that they've been showing off all year. You know, and just kind of talking about kind of future scenarios and situations. I mean, I feel like, yeah, they picked a good company, a company that, at least for right now, doesn't have a whole lot of reason to really get involved to stop them from doing anything moving forward. But I think that we're just so early with all this VR stuff that we don't really know what the scenario is going to be. So, you know, I mean, we didn't really get any new Oculus news, but I definitely feel like a year in, Facebook has basically given them the money they need and the resources maybe to continue doing what they were already doing. But other than that, they've stayed out of it. And frankly, as a fan of Oculus, I think that's been the best case scenario. So that's been good.
They demonstrated a kind of a 360-degree immersive video through that. I guess we were going through Cinque Terre in Italy. It requires 24 cameras. So this isn't something I'm going to do with my smartphone. And it doesn't work with Oculus Rift. It's like, sometimes I feel like they're just throwing stuff against the wall. I don't really get it. All right. Although Instagram has a new app called Layout that does exactly what a dozen apps before it have done, frames,
including
pictures.
One called Layout. He's not happy. And I'm like, are you
new? Oh, I bet not.
I mean, I feel for the guy, but at the same time, I'm like, are you new?
Yeah,
this is
he's been Sherlocked.
You know,
yeah,
precisely, and you know, this is not unique to Facebook. It's Sherlocked is the perfect. That's exactly what it is.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think the reason Facebook said that they did it though was really interesting. They said that something like one out of every six users uses a Layout tool app to make photo collages. that's a huge amount of, that's a huge percentage. And so, yeah, absolutely, Facebook needed to completely like bring that in house and at least have an option, because if that many of your users are using a collage tool, I'm actually kind of curious why they didn't just build it into the app itself and made it a separate app. I would kind of guess, even though Facebook and Instagram are fond of doing this separate app philosophy, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point they just decided to merge the layout feature directly into Instagram itself. Because if that many of your users are first starting out with a collage tool, to me, that indicates that's probably an area where you could slip that into the main app.
Sure.
And you wouldn't have people getting upset. You might have even increased usage at that right. point.
Yeah, the experience of taking a picture not in Instagram, but starting outside of Instagram, going through one app into Instagram is not a great experience. It's too fussy. Speaking of Oculus Rift, HTC has said we are going to invite people to join our developer program and get a developer edition for free. Rift was charging $300 for its developer edition. A lot of people saw Vive at Mobile World Congress and raved about it. I guess the key at this point, you're in a race to get people to create content for these things.
Right. Which is the hard thing, right? Like that's going to be the challenge. I think, at this point, Oculus has sucked most of the energy out of the room. So that's probably what HTC has to do to get people interested. They need to give those things away to developers, because otherwise, why would they want to bother when already the Oculus, ecosystem is sort of fragmented when you talk about the difference between Oculus Rift and then the Samsung Oculus-based platforms, which are different. It's already getting sort of fragmented. So I'm not surprised at all that HTC and Steam are like, yes, please sign up and we will give you one of these.
Sony has its own. It has the best name, Project Morpheus.
Yes.
Definitely the best name. Of course, The Matrix. And they've been giving development kits out since last year. Sony has said, it's interesting, they told Polygon about a year ago, we don't want people to think, how can I port this game to virtual reality or VR? We want people to think, what unique thing can we do with this tech?
Mm.
And to that end, as I mentioned, we talked to Ben Rubin at Meerkat, and he didn't want to go into details, but he was very excited about this idea of live streaming virtual reality. In a way, Meerkat kind of is. It takes you into somebody's life in an interesting way, but it's a very constrained little peephole into their life. Wouldn't it be amazing if it could be a VR experience?
Yeah.
I would go for that. So one of the things people do a lot with Meerkat, I've done it quite a bit, is you Meerkat while you're driving. And it'd be so cool if you could be in the passenger seat looking around, talking to somebody while they're Meerkatting. That would be interesting. You'd look like a dork. And you'd have to have a giant camera. I don't know what those camera rigs look like, but...
There's this analogy. I mean, this is sort of a larger issue, but there's an analogy about technology development and the rollout of electricity to different countries. So in the United States, when electricity was first being brought into people's houses, it was called like your light bill. It was for powering lights, and that's what we used it for. And we made it very, very cheap and very accessible to get electricity into people's homes and businesses. So that allowed people to experiment with other ways we could use electricity. And of course, from there, the whole 20th century happened. So the same analogy is being made with the internet. So countries that have fiber optic and really high speed, fast internet available to people's homes allows them to tinker and think about, what can we do with this access that maybe we're not imagining right now? And there's a lot of critics in the United States who are saying, the caps that we have on our internet speed is just ridiculous and it's preventing innovation from happening. And so it just kind of reminds me, when you're talking about like trying to think and experiment with Oculus Rift in a new way, what else can we do with VR that we haven't thought of yet? It's sort of similar to that. It's like we need to give people unfettered mega access and let them play in a sandbox.
They never show, and I was a little mad at Facebook during, by the way, they completely wasted their second day keynote, which could have been about Oculus Rift, and instead the chief scientist did a lot of optical illusions everybody in the world has seen 100 times. But what they could have done, and I would like to have seen, is the camera. What do you need? Because forget the headset. That's what you use to consume it, what does it take to make it? Because that's what you got to get people doing, is doing innovative things with making it. Is it a giant thing? Is it a little thing? Have they talked about that? If I could buy a little camera that I put right here that will allow you to be in the studio with us, I would be very interested in doing that, for instance. There it is. Is that it? What are you showing me?
It's a rig you could get where you have like a 16 GoPros or something, and then you could stitch it all together.
Okay, that's not going to work.
That's crazy.
I wish they would talk about the creation tools. You know, it's so funny, in the developer kit, they give you the consumer tool, but not the creation tool. I mean, I don't think creating it in software is really the solution. Oculus Rift camera. Let me Google that. All right, let's talk. Let's see. Oh, I guess you don't need a big elaborate camera. Here's a stereo camera. I guess all you need is two. It's $159. So you really only need two cameras, right? But then if I turn my head, how do I do that? How does that work? Yeah, this isn't going to do it. All right, Chris, I've given you my Oculus Rift development kit. It is now your job to figure out how we can create immersive VR experiences here in the studio. Okay? He's 17. Get to work, kid. Cameras, cameras, schmammers. If Thomas Edison had said, "I need a light bulb," would he have invented the phonograph?
He needed a filament.
Oh, he needed a filament. All right.
You need 12 GoPros.
12 GoPros. I've got three. We can get you started anyway.
I've got a fourth.
Yahoo and Microsoft are in a 10-year deal for Microsoft Bing to be the Yahoo search engine. That deal is about to, let's see, the search partnership took place in 2010. But it did allow them to renegotiate in 2015 after 5 years. The negotiations are going on, and I don't know if they're going well. They've decided to extend them for another 30 days. This is because both companies are publicly held, so they had to file with the SEC on Friday. They mutually agreed to extend the deadline to a 60-day period following February 23rd. Not clear what's going on there. I can't imagine Yahoo would abandon Bing. They don't have anything to replace it. All right. Actually, let's take a break, and then we'll talk about the FTC and Google. Is Google a monopoly? Should the FTC have pursued them for antitrust? They decided not to, but some say after they've read these documents, they should have. We'll talk about it. Our guests, great to have them, Katie Benner from Bloomberg View, which is you said it's like commentary.
Exactly. It's Bloomberg News' commentary section. Opinion. We're all columnists.
This is good. I like it. You should get people to go and read more of this.
Oh, no, you're going to get people to go and read more of this.
This is good stuff.
I know.
This is good stuff. Why are they segregating it?
Well, because they want to keep the news and the commentary separate, right. Just sort of like the New York Times does or the Wall Street Journal. They have the opinion section, the opinion pages, so yeah. That people don't conflate it with news. That's all.
Well, I'm going to forget the other guys. I'm going to read this one.
Fantastic.
And I like the layout. It's very. This is the new Bloomberg layout.
Exactly. It's very vergy.
It was controversial when they did it. But you're not quite as all in as the rest of Bloomberg.
Mm-mm. No, I think that site is much more. There are a lot more bells and whistles on
that site.
That's
kooky.
They've done a really great job.
I'm going to give you some opinion. That's kooky. What they did is so. It feels like it's rendering wrong or something. Don't you? I don't know. You shouldn't. You can't talk. But just feels like there's stuff not, and this stuff's popping out and moving around, and then when you read an article, it has a. It like it feels like stuff's. I don't know. It looks kooky.
Commentary is more restrained. On
yeah, the I like the. I like the view. So look, there's this blue bar. See that blue bar at the top? As you scroll down, it moves across to tell you something. I don't know what where you are in the article, but it's not that helpful because it's an infinite scroll. So as soon as you get to the bottom of the article, it resets and starts over again. Wait,
you can't
what?
See me off camera cracking up.
Can you talk to your boss?
I will send you an email address for RF Patterson.
No, I'm just kidding. That's fine.
You guys can have a great conversation.
It's fine. I just, you know, we're in the midst of a redesign, and I'm very, very aware of all the things you have to figure out and how hard it is. It's how expensive it is. And so I look at other sites with interest, like, well, okay, these are the decisions, because I know what decisions we have to make, and these are the decisions they made. And actually, it works perfectly well. I think it's very, it's bold.
Thank you very much.
Very bold.
If you are looking for something to read on Bloomberg View, I did just write a column about Google and antitrust. So that's the first thing you guys can go and look for.
I'm going to put you on the spot then when we come back.
Sounds good.
From this break.
All righty.
Our show today brought to you by My Mattress. Do you have the video of me and my mattress? Me and my mattress. Who would have thought you could buy a mattress online? That seems like counterintuitive for so many reasons. One, don't you want to lie on it before you buy it? Two, they're going to ship a mattress? Three, what the heck? Well, Casper's convinced me. First of all, I have, and everybody has, gone to a mattress showroom and lied on a mattress. And it's 5 minutes on a mattress isn't going to do you any good. So with Casper, you get 100 days. The shipping is free and the return is free. If after 100 nights, I should say, sleeping on it for 100 nights, if you don't love your Casper mattress, they'll take it back. No problem. No questions asked. But they have done it so well. First of all, it does come in. That's a queen size mattress in a box. I got one for my son because he lives up three stories and he wanted a queen size mattress. There was no way they could get a regular mattress in that house. He loves his Casper mattress. They make them in the United States. They're premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. They're really comfy. I got to tell you, latex and memory foam. So you get both sink and bounce. You get firmness, but it conforms to you. It is so soft and comfortable, and it's completely risk-free to try it. Casper.com/twit, CASPER.com/twit. Don't decide on something you're going to sleep on for the next 10 years, 5 minutes in a showroom. Even Ozzy loves our Casper, by the way. Go online, Casper.com, and get a Casper mattress. I guarantee you, you are going to love it. Are your money back? $500 for a twin, $950 for a king size. Compare that to the price of the mattress store. And I'm going to get you $50 off as an audience member. Just go to Casper.com/twit and use the promo code TWIT. $50 off Casper. This is the kind of thing I think the internet really, it's interesting to watch how it's changing these businesses that you never thought you'd be able to buy glasses online or buy mattresses online. And they've solved this by shoes online. I love it. Casper.com/twit. So, the Wall Street Journal filed a Freedom of Information Act with the FTC, and they were curious about the process the FTC had used in investigating the Google. The FTC, I guess this is, now, and I'm glad you've written on this, Katie, so you can tell me. My sense is the FTC commissioners get reports from a variety of different staff groups, read them all, and then the commissioners decide whether to go forward or not. In this case, the commissioners declined to prosecute Google after a few minor changes to how Google does search. But in this FOIA Act, the Wall Street Journal, and by the way, the FTC asked for it back, and the journal said, no, we got it now, no, went through this and pulled out some smoking guns.
That they did. It was clear that the commission, that there were certain staffers who believed that Google, not just that Google had a monopoly, because monopolies exist in all sorts of businesses, but that they had used that power to hurt other companies and or hurt consumer interests. So that would be the antitrust part of the suit. As you said, in the end, the commission chose not to sue, and they worked with Google to preemptively change parts of the business so they wouldn't have to. What I was writing about, what I found interesting, is that the idea of a monopoly and the in technology is really different from monopolies that exist in things like oil and gas and mining and sort of these big, heavy industries, because it's hard, very hard to disrupt ExxonMobil. It's really hard for a company to have the firepower to upend that business. Whereas in technology, we see really big companies being upended all the time. You know, we've seen, in part because you have powerful, smart quick startups coming in and finding pieces of the business that are weak, and also because consumer trends change so fast in the tech world that what was interesting and great at one point just doesn't work anymore. I think Microsoft is a great example of this. Other people have written about this as well, that when, as long as the PC was king, Microsoft was going to be king too. But now that we're moving to mobile, suddenly the operating system and the software that Microsoft provides and is known for have just kind of become irrelevant. So that powerful monopoly that Microsoft wielded is not as scary anymore. And it wasn't because the government broke up Microsoft, and it wasn't because Microsoft changed its business practices. It really was just because Microsoft didn't keep up with technology as quickly as it should have. And I think people are already starting to wonder, is Google going to fall into that category as well? Now that we're moving away from online search and so much is being done in mobile search and being done in apps, where is Google in all of this? And then the couple of advantages they do have, Android, for example, you have companies going in, creating forked versions of Android, even trying to dent that advantage as well.
What was the smoking gun? Or was there anything, in your opinion, after reading through the report? And the Journal did a weird thing. They only published every other page for some reason. I don't really understand.
Well, they didn't get the whole report.
Oh, okay.
So the complete report wasn't included in the FOIA request. There were definitely some things in there that would be deemed harmful to other competitors. And this is why Amazon and Yelp and TripAdvisor have been so upset. You know, the commission did find that Google suppresses other companies' results in Google's own search results. So if information that would come up, you know, if Christina is shopping for something and she Googles in the item and she wants to buy it, maybe the best result would actually be from Amazon, but Google's going to give her a Google shopping result, right, which may or, right, you know, probably doesn't benefit the consumer in the long run. So yeah, that's true. But then there's the argument to be made, well, if we're searching on our phones, I'm probably not ever going to Google what I want to buy on my phone. I'm going to go straight to my Amazon app, disintermediating Google, and then making their monopoly a lot less powerful. And even if they are abusing that monopoly, it doesn't matter because I'm not using them.
Jeff Jarvis, we had a long discussion on this week in Google, and Jeff defended Google, saying that really this is the Wall Street Journal continuing a vendetta. It's Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal continuing a vendetta against Google. And then Danny Sullivan's done a very interesting analysis on Marketing Land, his site, in which he said basically, here's one quote. And this comes from a sidebar to the main piece, how Google skewed search results. According to the journal, Google would automatically boost its own sites for certain specialized searches that would otherwise favor rivals. Kind of what you mentioned, Katie. If a comparison shopping site was supposed to rank highly, Google shopping was placed above it. When Yelp was deemed relevant to a user's search query, Google Local would pop up on top. Danny says that sounds terrible on the face of it, unless you understand that this is a practice that many search engines have done to present vertical, and this is the key, these are vertical search results. It said Google, he says Google didn't want to give you search results as the result of a search, and deemed that things like Yelp would basically, you'd search for something and you get a search. And so that, you know, to some degree that seems reasonable. On the other hand, the journal says Google had a focus group, they call them the searchers, who were very unhappy with the way Google was doing things. Marissa Meyer, who was then a Google vice president, said Google didn't use click-through rates to determine the rankings for its own specialized search results because they'd rank too low. So
right. Well, I mean, and that's kind of, I don't know about you guys, but I found myself, one of the reasons that I think Google suffers so much on mobile, A, as you said, Katie, you know, you don't, we want to go to the app rather than going through a search box. But part of the reason that's the case is because over time, I don't know about you guys, but I've noticed that my Google results have gotten less and less good. And a lot of times it's because they're customized now to everything they think that I want to like. So it becomes kind of this weird, like, circular notion where I'm only seeing things that I've searched for before or sites I've visited before. But in other cases, it's because it takes so long to actually find the real results that I want, versus what, you know, they used to do, but they were so good at. And the reason they disrupted the industry was that, you know, Google was fantastic about showing the actual things that you wanted and showing like the highest probably, you know, really kind of anticipating this is where you want to go. So, I mean, on the one hand, I think this definitely, I can understand why their competitors are upset. On the other hand, I almost wonder, you know, by doing this and putting their own services above others, doesn't that in some ways potentially just make people want to use Google less because the results they're getting aren't actually matching what they're searching for. They're getting, you know, siphoned off into Google Local and all these other things that probably don't even exist anymore, rather than going to Yelp or going to Amazon, which is kind of what you wanted to do to begin with.
Of course. And I think that the comparison with Microsoft here becomes really fascinating because,
yes,
again, Microsoft did so much to enhance and protect a monopoly position that it took its eye off the ball in terms of innovation. And then some of the things,
yes,
that it did do in order to stay so powerful made the experience just bad for,
right,
users. So the
That's
minute
the risk,
I had
isn't
a chance
it?
Yeah. to go anywhere else, the minute there was a Google Docs, yeah, or the minute like Apple software was even like kind of okay, people started finding other options.
But isn't that why this is an antitrust investigation? Because the whole, it's not illegal to be a monopoly. It's illegal,
no,
to use your monopoly power to enter other markets. And so the reason this is a legitimate, in my opinion, investigation is because Google used its near monopoly on search,
right,
to get itself into other businesses, like,
right,
Google Local.
Part of the problem is like, do we have a clear and defined idea of what a search engine is? Having only had search engines for what, maybe 20 years at this point? So what I'm saying is, Google's service offers, when you go to google.com, it offers you a lot of services. When you use the Chrome web app, it offers you a lot of services. So, or web app, I'm sorry, browser. It offers you a lot of different services. So when you Google a restaurant, for example, you're going to get a Google Maps results.
Right.
You're going to get reviews of people who have entered it from their Google accounts. You're going to get photos of the place from people who have uploaded them to Google. You know, is that part of a search engine experience? Is that something else? Is what Google offers now something different than a search engine? Like, I think it gets into this weird area where I almost see these things that Google is offering us as other services and features on top of its site.
And I think the FTC thing really only dealt with traditional online search, as you would think of it. It didn't deal with all of these other areas. It really just dealt with opening up a web browser and typing something into the search bar.
But I mean, that's exactly what Google is delivering you, right? Like, that's the promise that Google makes, is that we're going to follow what you do. We're going to try to offer you tailored results. And we're going to give you a complex, rich, and in context experience for what it is you're looking for. So that's why you get the maps and the photos and the business listing. And it's going to show you that business listing instead of Yelp's because it's Google and it wants to offer you that. But it sounds kind of tricky to me because I don't know if that is what a search engine offers or if that's something new. Like, is that a feature on top of a search engine, or does Google, by offering those features, now enter into a new category in a way?
Well, and it's old-fashioned to think of a search engine as merely something you type a phrase into and it gives you a list of sites that match the phrase. That's kind of our old-fashioned notion of what Google is. And you're saying, I think quite rightly, that Google wants to be more useful than that.
But also the FTC closed its investigation. Like, we're debating this,
right,
years after the fact. This, right, is over. Google was,
exactly,
found not to be, you know, trust busting. They were found innocent. So
I've argued for this, and of course it's pie in the sky, but I do wish there were a search. It's part of the problem is Google is a monopoly. It's not like you're going,
right,
to go,
it
use
is,
something else.
Of course it is.
I mean, I guess you could use Bing.
Which is not illegal. I mean, there.
But it's not illegal, right? And I kind of wish there were some holy priesthood search engine that didn't have all these side businesses, didn't have YouTube and
DuckDuckGo.
But DuckDuckGo uses Google's results.
Yes, it does.
But it strips all that other stuff out.
Right.
And they have some of their own crawling, although it's very minor.
They have not yet done their own business of crawling,
no,
and that's what they need. If they would do that and say, look, we're just going to hew to the one thing, which is to provide you results that you will be useful to you, and we are not in any other business, so we cannot help our other businesses, I would like that. I would switch to that.
I think the problem is, though, is that almost is like that's the last you know, technology, that's the old paradigm, right? That was kind of like the web 1.0, web 2.0 search paradigm. Whereas where Google is actually frankly losing now and where search is going in the future is that people are using their mobile devices. And it becomes about being anticipatory, which is why Google needs to do more of these customized things. And they need to learn more about us because they need to be able to know if you're in this area and I'm searching for a Starbucks, you should show me the Starbucks closest to where I am, right. Not, you know, their website or something else. You know, you should be showing me, you know, if I'm looking for an airline or time or something, you know, for takeoff and landing, you should be searching for that day, not for, you know, just general information. So I think that I am with you, but I almost wonder if going that direction is going in the past and kind of away from how most of us are kind of going to be using search in the future.
No, I agree. Google now makes it much more useful, and that's a very different beast than a pure search engine. Google's response to this, by the way, and one of the accusations from the Wall Street Journal was that, of course, this happened because since President Obama took office, employees of Google have visited the White House 230 times.
Oh, God, that was
230. In comparison, Comcast has only visited twice.
Buried way, way down in that story. And this is why it's so important to read to the very end.
Yeah.
The journal does acknowledge that a lot of those visits were so that employees at Google could help set up President Obama's, you know, Q&A that went over Google Hangouts. You know, these were not policy people.
Five of them, according to Google, were a Google engineer on leave helping to fix technical issues with healthcare.gov's website.
Those people were people who were actually going in and out to apply for jobs, you know, at the White House. You have to get really far down in the story before it becomes clear maybe why there were so many more visits previously.
Over a dozen visits were for production crews covering the YouTube interviews with the president following the State of the Union.
Right, exactly.
By the way, that was Alex Lindsay and his crew, Pixel Corps. I love the picture that they put in the Google blog. This is in their policy blog. Really, Rupert? And then they got a baby laughing.
No, I love that they're responding with GIFs now to
animated GIFs. That's the solution.
I mean, to me, I kind of love it. What's interesting, obviously, I know this case was already decided, but what to me was more bothersome than even some of this, you know, monopolistic practice stuff, which obviously we know they have. But the fact that they were, you know, the argument was, and there seemed to be proof of this, that they were kind of holding Amazon ransom to a certain extent, saying, you have to pay us this amount of money for ads if we're going to show your search results on our pages at all.
Exactly.
To me, that's actually wrong. A lot more bothersome than even in the other stuff, because then I'm thinking, okay, take away the sanctity of search out of it. You're now basically saying to one of your pseudo competitors in some ways, but also one of your biggest customers, that the only way that you'll continue to kind of show the results where they should be shown is if they continue to pay you.
Right.
I mean, that's some Microsoft stuff right there.
Wrong.
That's some pure Microsoft, like from the 90s sort of stuff right there. So on the one hand, I'm like, okay, well played. Somebody read Bill's handbook. On the other hand, I'm like, wow, that's don't be evil my ass. You know, like, come on.
I have to say that Google wields such power in our society.
People are going to start.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Those are the things that people are going to start scrutinizing.
Yeah.
The FTC stuff's closed, but just like Christina said, there are interesting tidbits. There were interesting insights into Google's business practices that will probably be put under the spotlight more than they were before.
Rightly so. Google wields a lot of power. And I think we need to keep them honest. You know what else we need to keep honest? Radio Shack. Radio Shack is, of course, going out of business. In their bankruptcy sale, they are offering tens of millions of email and home addresses to the highest bidder. Did you ever join the Radio Shack Battery Club? Do you remember when you bought something at Radio Shack, they'd ask you for their phone number? Well,
yes.
Now you know where it's going. 13 million email addresses, 65 million customer names and physical addresses. And they're trying to sell it off as part of their assets. AT&T's complaining, not because AT&T is in favor of privacy. Oh, no.
No.
Because they say, that's our data.
No. Right, exactly. They're like, no, you can't resell this. We already own this. We get to profit from it, not you. That's my favorite part.
It's important, I think, it's important to know because we often point to privacy policies. And Radio Shack did have a privacy policy in place, but most of the time these privacy policies do not survive the sale or liquidation of a company.
They do not. Absolutely.
So,
and this is one reason why I would refuse to give the Radio Shack people my name or my zip code or sign up to buy the $5 insurance plan on my $25 Ethernet to USB adapter? And I would say, no, I'm not going to buy that. And they look at me funny. And I think this is also one reason why I don't think any of us are upset that they're going out of business, because this is the first thing they do.
Wow. In the past, the FTC, again, has said that if something like this is happening during a liquidation, data should be sold with a larger group of assets, not just parceled out to the highest bidder by themselves, that the privacy policy should be maintained and the buyer should be in the same general line of business. But, you know, this is an example of why you might want to be a little careful about the information you give out. We're out of time, but what a great time we had. I want to thank you all three for being here. Jill Duffy, PCMag.com. Anything you want to plug?
I still have my column, Get Organized, every Monday. The one coming out tomorrow is about freeing up some space on your iPhone. So
That's easier said than done.
Get hyphen. You know, it's kind of so the gist of my column is it's really for everybody. I'm not talking about high-tech stuff where you have to do any scripting or, you know, unlock an Android phone. Like, it's really basic tips. I want it to be understandable for the people who don't really dig into their technology that much. They're just ordinary people. They want to use their phones. They want them to work. So I try to write simple, clear tips for people that everybody can understand.
We all need that. That's a great great thing, great service. PCMag.com/get-organized. Thank you, Jill, for being here.
Oh, thank you, Leo.
Katie Benner, she writes at the much more lovely BloombergView.com. Very well-designed site. Thank you for being here, Katie. Anything you'd want to plug?
I am a columnist at Bloomberg View, and I write a couple of times a week. But I also have a daily newsletter where I round up all of the best tech news of the day, and I do my take on what's important and what you should be looking for.
I need to get that. Where do I get that?
I will shoot you an email the minute we're off the air.
Plug it on the air. What are you talking about? Plug it.
We're redesigning the whole thing.
So you don't want anybody to know about it yet.
But right, if you want to subscribe, there's an RSS. You can just go to my site, or you can email me, kbenner2@bloomberg.net, and I will send you the tiny letter URL to subscribe.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that easy.
That sounds great. Christina Warren, always a pleasure, from Mashable.com, the king of the meerkat. But you were saying that's not you.
That's not me.
That's what's his name? Pete Cashmore.
That's Pete Cashmore. That's our very pretty CEO.
He is too damn good looking.
He really is. He really is. It's not fair.
The chiseled cheekbones.
Yes, it's ridiculous how good looking he is.
The fashionista. Is he? You know, he's shy. That's what cracks me up.
So shy. He's so shy, which is why it's so funny that he's become such a meerkat whore, because he's the shyest person in the world. So it's really bizarre. I love it.
He still sounds like a Scotsman, right?
He does.
Good.
He does.
That's, as long as he doesn't lose that. I love Pete. And we used to. He was on the show a couple of times. And he was just too shy. He didn't want to do it. He says, "No, I don't want to be in public." But we just think he's the greatest. Give him my regards. Thank you, all three of you. We appreciate your being here. We had a good day, a good week, a good week on Twit. And if you missed any of it, here's some of what you missed.
Previously on Twit.
Hear the whoop, 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 whoop. Yeah.
Triangulation.
I am becoming increasingly convinced that the notion now is corporate life cycle. A corporation is built for a certain technology and paradigm of it.
Times change, and they change faster now than they ever have before.
All about Android.
Miriam, you brought in a pretty fine piece of hardware, if I do say so myself, the HTC One M9.
Yes, this is a phenomenal, fantastic phone. It's going to be one of the top 5 phones this year. No doubt about it, except for the camera.
Before you buy.
We put an uncrashable Parrot Bebop into the hands of our very own Leo Laporte.
It's very easy to use, and that's a good thing, since the last one I lost in the sky. No, come back, drone! It did it again! Land, land, land!
Gizwiz.
What the heck is this? You know what this is?
No.
That goes into his mouth.
What?
And that is going to be a guide to shave a perfect goatee. Oh, that's pretty good.
Twit.
Friends don't let friends miss Twit.
We cover everything on Twit. If you missed any of that, well, just tune in this week because it's going to be another great week, and especially tomorrow, Triangulation with Ben Rubin, the founder of Meerkat. We do This Week in Tech Sunday afternoons, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. It's 2200 UTC at live.twit.tv. If you can't be here live, and we love it if you are, but if you can't, you can always email us. I'm sorry, email. Why would you email us? I don't know. We'll send you a copy. No. Just go to twit.tv. That's where it is. You don't have to email us. Just download a copy there or wherever podcasts are stored. We also have great Twit apps on all the devices, all the mobile devices, Android, iOS, Windows Phone, even Roku. If you want to be in studio, we would love that. We have changed our policy just a little bit. We do require that you email us now, tickets@twit.tv. We'd appreciate it if you let us know ahead of time. That way we will make sure we always have a place for you to sit. We're going to have to start turning away walk-ins, I'm afraid. So email us first, tickets@twit.tv. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Don't forget, April 19th, the 10th anniversary Twit with all the original members of the Twit cast. It's going to be a lot of fun. April 19th, our 10th anniversary. See you next time. Another Twit is in the can.